Good afternoon. It's Wednesday, the 10th of April, 2024, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Mike Robinson. Joining me today, we've got Vanessa Bailey from Damascus and Charles Mallett. Welcome to the programme both. Now we're going to get started with David Cameron and Ukraine, in a sense. But David Cameron was in Washington yesterday, and we're going to label this as a sick mind. And I have to say, David Cameron has a sick mind. I'll explain that in a second. But just before I do, this was him in Washington yesterday, but just today, just before we came on the news program, the UK government has announced a Ukraine defence pact between the UK and Ukraine. And the quote that Charles particularly noticed from this says, the UK has now provided almost £12 billion in military, humanitarian and economic support to Ukraine and has often been the first mover in vital lethal aid from Storm Shadow cruise missiles to squadron of Challenger 2 tanks. So perhaps that sets the scene on why I'm suggesting David Cameron has a sick mind, because while he was in Washington yesterday, well, he began by going to see Donald Trump. He then met Antony Blinken, but he was really there to try to get past the blockage in funding from Congress. So he was there to try to bully Congress into continuing to fund arms into Ukraine. But during the press conference afterwards, this is what he had to say.
Listen to me, I argue that it is extremely good value for money for the United States and for others, perhaps for about 5 or 10% of your defense budget. Almost half of Russia's pre-war military equipment has been destroyed without the loss of a single American life. This is an investment in United States security. So that's what I would say.
So I'd like to get your thoughts on this from both of you. Vanessa first. I mean, am I wrong in suggesting that there's sick mind at work that would make a statement like that?
So what he's basically said is hundreds of thousands of Ukrainian lives sacrificed in a NATO proxy war against Russia is more bang for your buck.
Indeed, yes.
Translation, right?
Yeah. Yes.
That's disgusting. I mean, it's unbelievable, or maybe not, but it is sick.
Charles, what are your thoughts?
Good afternoon, Mike. Good afternoon, all. Well, I think obviously Vanessa makes a very good point. The other thing he refers to is an investment in American security, and given past experience, if we're to take it at face value, antagonizing or indeed creating a sense of aggression against Russia is only likely to have the backfire effect of further anti-Western, anti-American sentiment. So I think that's another thing that he's very much overlooked, and also knocking Russia back into the Stone Age economically would not be to the benefit of any of the nations that are talking about it.
Indeed. So thank you for that. Now, in the meantime, in Ukraine itself, the Ukrainians have now attacked the Zaporizhia nuclear power station twice over the last 3 or 4 days. This is TASS reporting. Ukraine drone shot down over Zaporizhia nuclear power plant. Debris falls on roof of Unit 6. This is the quote from the ZNPP itself. Ukraine's attempts to shell the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant continue today. A kamikaze drone was shot down over the power plant. It fell on the roof of the 6th power unit. Threats to the ZNPP's safety have not been identified. Now, Mario Grossi, the Director General of the IAEA, had this to say: this is a major escalation of the nuclear safety and security dangers facing the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant. Such reckless attacks significantly increase the risk of a major nuclear accident and must cease immediately. Well, what was the American position on this? This is Matthew Miller, the State Department spokesman, said. He said it's dangerous that they've done that. That's the Ukrainians. And we continue to call on Russia to withdraw its military and civilian personnel from the plant, to return full control of the plant to the competent Ukrainian authorities, and refrain from taking any actions that could result in a nuclear incident at the plant. Again, this is, I just wonder what the mentality is of these people, Vanessa, where the Ukrainians bomb a nuclear power station, and the US says that that Russia needs to refrain from doing anything which is going to result in a nuclear incident.
Yeah, I mean, they're just in constant denial mode. I mean, when Israel bombs an Iranian embassy on Syrian soil, they deny it. They deny that Israel is committing atrocities in Gaza or is actually carrying out a genocide. And now basically it's passed the buck back to Russia, even though their proxy is the one that's carried out the attack. It is just obscene, actually.
Yes. So in the meantime, the obscenity continues because the RAF has now deployed a squadron to Romania. So here they are. This is all about NATO's eastern flank and protecting NATO's eastern flank. Of course, this is close to the Black Sea. So the RAF Typhoon fighters are now taking part in a four-month mission. It's a sort of rotating mission. So they've done this before. They'll do it again in the future, I'm sure, with jets from 9 Bomber Squadron, along with more than 200 RAF personnel from 140 Expeditionary Air Wing, deployed from RAF Lossiemouth. Into Romania, and they'll fly alongside the Romanian Air Force as part of NATO's enhanced air policing mission until August. And of course, this is all about engaging with Russian aircraft. So they're very keen to make sure that we know that aircraft frequently intercepted by the RAF during previous air policing missions include Russian long-range strategic bombers, surveillance aircraft and transport aircraft, and various other intercepts, they say, are key to maintaining airspace security and protecting international borders, as well as acting as a clear deterrent against threats. This is what Grant Shapps had to say. Our NATO air policing deployment helps keep Europe's skies secure, ready to launch at a moment's notice for the next 4 months. The Typhoon pilots will respond with professionalism to threats and incidents in support of our collective security. Charles, later on, you're going to be talking about war readiness and so on, but are you buying any of the rhetoric from the British government on this?
No, I'm afraid not. And as you say, I will come on to specify exactly why not. But it at the moment seems like an awful lot of bluster with no substance at all.
Indeed. It gets even better because there's been an update on AUKUS. Now, of course, AUKUS is the Trilateral Security and Defence Partnership between Australia, UK and US. It was first announced in September 2021. As they would describe it, it sees the three nations work together on a range of capabilities to support a free and open Indo-Pacific, including conventionally armed nuclear-powered submarine capability for the UK and Australia under Pillar 1 of the partnership. Now, of course, this is about moving the war narrative towards China. And again, let's bring Grant Shapps on screen here. He had this to say: in a more dangerous world, relationships and partnerships like AUKUS are more important than ever. We've always said we would engage additional nations in our Pillar 2 work as it progresses, and collaborating with like-minded countries will strengthen the partnership further. Now, the question is, what's he talking about? Well, they said that with respect to Pillar 2, they would bring new countries in. And in this case, they're talking about Japan. So the Japanese, very keen to get involved. The Chinese, not so excited about it as we might expect. So this was a release from the Chinese embassy in the UK through CCTV. The Chinese news agency, and they're saying the Chinese embassy in the United Kingdom on Tuesday voiced firm opposition to the United States, the UK and Australia's insistence on advancing the so-called trilateral security partnership in disregard of the wide concerns of regional countries and the international community about nuclear proliferation risks. And they're saying, we urge the US, the UK and Australia to abandon the Cold War mentality, stop cobbling together exclusionary blocks, and cease stirring trouble and camp confrontation in the Asia-Pacific region. Japan must learn lessons from history and be prudent about its words and actions when it comes to military security. And again, this is expansionism. We're going to come on to NATO expansionism in just a second. But Vanessa, again, we're expanding our reach with a view to putting pressure on certain countries. And how are they supposed to respond to this?
Well, yeah, I mean, this is the thing, isn't it? We are constantly in the West, and the allies or the proxies of the West are constantly expanding the conflict by effectively violating international law and provoking the expansion of the conflict, and then acting victim when there is a response to the provocation, despite the fact that Russia, China, and Iran are trying to maintain an equilibrium, which the West is constantly trying to break.
Yes. And just on the continuing on the subject of expansion, coming back to NATO, and of course the discussion has been had over the last couple of years, particularly since the special military operation in Ukraine kicked off, about why Russia is doing this, and denials from the West about any guarantees given to Russia about expansion. Well, more documents have been released now through the National Security Archive in the United States, and basically admitting that they had promised Russia that there would be no interference in the internal affairs of CIS countries, that's the Commonwealth of Independent States. And in fact, the documents show that they then, having given those guarantees, this is in the 1994 to 1997 time period, they went straight on ahead and did interfere in those countries to the degree that they pursued color revolution. So I just take a quote here from Open Democracy to give an example. This is from a report called Democratization, NGOs and Color Revolutions. And they say these three revolutions, the Rose Revolution in Georgia, the Orange Revolution in Ukraine, and the Tulip Revolution in Kyrgyzstan, each followed a near identical trajectory. All were spearheaded by the American democratization international NGOs working at the behest of the U.S. of U.S. foreign policy establishment. And this is the key point. Russia in particular has been on the receiving end of, and the countries around Russia have been on the receiving end of the activities from international NGOs. And that has resulted in or assisted the expansion of NATO eastwards and helped build this pressure. But just to end this segment, I've just got a little bit of video here from Ukraine. And let's just have a look at this. So Vanessa, just very quickly, just to do a quick translation, the children there were singing "Our Father is Bandera," and I mean it's just incredible the claims that that there's no Nazi interest or Nazi indoctrination in Ukraine, and then we see video clips like that.
Yeah, I mean that, you know, the extremist supremacist indoctrination goes across all of the countries that are allied with the West, including of course Israel. Which starts there, the indoctrination starts in kindergarten, and clearly the same in Ukraine. But yep, there's no Nazi ideology in Ukraine.
Indeed. Okay, thank you for that. Now, let's come on to UK's readiness. And well, we'll begin with Charles, NATO 75.
Yes, indeed. And back to David Cameron, I'm afraid, who spoke last week at the Royal United Services Institute, but the transcript of the speech was published yesterday. And what I'd like to draw out of this is the narrative that he's attempting to sort of contrive, as Mike says, on the anniversary of 75 years of NATO. So we just look at some of the text that he's using. And of course, he brings up the oft-repeated subject of Article 5, and an attack on one is an attack on all. I mean, it's quite clear that within all of this, what he's really talking about is Ukraine and the idea that the United Kingdom should go to war on Ukraine's behalf. But of course, Ukraine is not in NATO. Anyway, he goes on talking about the growing threat and saying that most of NATO's life has had a clear threat. We certainly have that today. Its success is clearly based on its continued expansion. Well, of course, I refer back to exactly what Mike's been saying about expansion in the previous segment. Anyhow, Cameron goes on to say, whilst it's clear NATO is not a participant in the conflict in Ukraine, the outcome of the war that happens in Ukraine is, in my view, absolutely vital to the future of Ukraine. And that's one of the reasons why Britain so strongly supports Ukraine's struggle. Well, I don't think there's a very coherent narrative running through that. But nonetheless, he continues to be talking about Ukraine as a part of NATO, a NATO that will be strong and everyone will see the strength of its alliance. Everyone will recognize Ukraine should be and will be a part of NATO. NATO's capability will grow and people will see that we in the West are capable of standing up to a threat of this magnitude. So not only do we see Ukraine being used as a proxy in the current conflict, but also the likes of David Cameron effectively using Ukraine by proxy to express the threat to NATO, because in effect, none has actually been articulated comprehensively from Russia. So he has to push on and create a story that suggests that that is the case. Now, what I'd like to do is look at the way in which, in effect, propaganda is being sold internally to the British Army. This is the April edition of Soldier magazine, an internal but certainly not restricted publication. And you'll just see on the front page there, the mission to prep Gen Z officers for war. Now, inside, there is a spread of several pages of what's been going on at the Royal Military Academy Sandhurst, which is where the army officer training is conducted, and effectively a total overhaul of the curriculum. But based on this premise, and with the service under firm instructions to prepare for war, and lessons from Ukraine's front lines coming thick and fast, an overhaul of sorts was inevitable. Well, for Sandhurst, that's actually quite a departure, because the whole point of Sandhurst training is that you're training for a war rather than the war. So it should be generic training, but obviously the focus here is very obviously specifically on Ukraine. Now, they've set themselves up for a bit of a fall in saying that if they succeed by next year, at least their commissioned officers should be coming out, or at least going through, as being curious, self-motivated, combat-ready, resilient, confident on long operations, exemplars of the Army's values and standards, innovative, brilliant problem solvers, digitally aware, and well-versed on combined arms manoeuvre. So combined arms manoeuvre is something that the MOD has been talking about in Poland, exactly like Mike was saying, the exercise that's going on at the minute. But again, just to concentrate on the numbers, they say that the United Kingdom has 1,300 men there, which equates to a combined arms battle group. So not really, given the sort of fanfare with which Cameron's talking about all this stuff, not really such a significant deployment. But all of this relates to the Future Soldier, published back in November 2021, when, of course, Russia had not commenced any of the activities it's now undertaking, and indeed nor had Ukraine. But just to look at understanding Future Soldier, I should draw your attention to the many, many references to climate change, which you might not quite be able to read in that opening paragraph. But effectively, this is a progressive system, the integrated operating concept, which Mike in particular has spoken a lot about before. And the reason I've put "you are here" is that the constrain function talks about the involvement of the use of force being a proactive and assertive element. And of course, it's only one step short of actual war fighting. So we've moved through protect and engage. And that's fairly significant. And I would say that when in the current climate, putting out graphics like this for Steadfast Defender, I mean, it looks very, very much like it is absolutely gearing up for war. And then just to go back to this edition of Soldier magazine, amazingly, this is what would be page one of the magazine, effectively an advertisement for people to put themselves forward for what's called Op Interflex, which is the training of Ukrainian troops in the UK. So what kind of capacity does that require? Well, the Ministry of Defence said in November last year that the total of Ukrainian troops that have now been trained in the UK is 52,000. Well, that is a staggering number, and should, on that basis, be regarded as an achievement by the British Armed Forces. But exactly like was discussed with Tim Davis, the retired fast jet pilot, a couple of weeks ago, the knock-on effect on Britain's ability to train its own soldiers will be enormous. To think that 52,000 foreign soldiers have gone through in the place of British troops is bound to have a very significant effect. So we'll just look at the numbers, the personnel numbers from last month, and we see that the picture is not a good one. The strength has decreased by 3%. The numbers joining has also decreased quite significantly, but it's the retention figure of 16,000 that ensures that we can see that we are probably not ready for war. Brian mentioned this just on Monday, warfighting readiness summarised by the House of Commons Defence Committee as being the ability to deploy and sustain a force that can fight at high intensity in multiple domains for a long period of time, and they find that to be in doubt. And then they talk about strategic readiness, which they describe as being still more of a concept under debate within government than an agreed policy with measurable deliveries. And then finally, they talk about recruitment and retention, and they give a pretty grim picture of the situation, which is that since Capita took over, they are only three quarters of the way through the recruitment year, but they'd recruited only barely half of the people they were targeted to by that time. So it doesn't look good at this stage, is the conclusion. And it's a far cry from what David Cameron has actually been talking about with regard to NATO and the impending conflict.
Yes, well, thank you for that, Charles. And I think we'd like to talk a little bit more about that in extra. But in the meantime, Vanessa, let's bring you on for proper segment here now. Iran, of course, we're still waiting to see what Iran is going to do with respect to the if there's going to be any retaliation over the bombing of the Iranian embassy in Damascus.
Oh, I think there's definitely going to be retaliation. There's been a lot of speculation circulating on social media. Why is Iran procrastinating, etc.? But I think, you know, this is part of its strategy. It doesn't react impulsively, just as Russia doesn't. Unlike the West, of course, which always does act either preemptively or impulsively. And what Iran has been doing, and of course, today is Eid, so it's the Ramadan. Also, I think that also was a factor playing into the decision of when to act. But what Iran has been doing is speaking to all of its allies in the region, ending, of course, with a visit in the last few days to Damascus. And this was a press conference between the two foreign ministers from Iran, Hossein Amir Abdollahian, and Dr. Faisal Mikdad from Syria. They also discussed the rebuilding of the consulate building within the embassy complex. So what did the Iranian foreign minister make very clear? He said that we held important discussions and consultations with President Bashar al-Assad, and we touched upon bilateral relations, important regional and international issues, especially those related to Palestine, the terrorist war committed by the Zionist entity against the Iranian consulate in Damascus. Stressing, of course, that Syria is going to be taking much of the brunt of any counter-retaliation by Israel as it's on the front line of the resistance. He also basically reiterated that he holds the allies of Israel responsible, and that includes, of course, the United States, the UK, and France. He also had a meeting, I think, on Sunday, with one of the spokespeople of Ansarullah, the coalition government in Yemen that has been effectively blockading the Red Sea. And he met with the Ansarullah spokesman and head of the negotiating delegation, Mohammed Abdul Salam, in Muscat in Oman, which is considered neutral. Now, what's interesting is immediately after the attack on the Iranian embassy, America actually tried to put forward a diplomatic solution or negotiation offer to Yemen. And this is a report by the Hindustani Times, which demonstrates exactly what Yemen's response was. So if we can just roll.
ونسعى باستمرار لتطوير إمكاناتنا الصاروخية والبحرية من أجل إسهام أكبر في دعم ومساندة الشعب الفلسطيني واستهداف العدو الإسرائيلي المجرم الغاصب.
Yemen, who effectively achieved probably the fastest victory against the US coalition in history, is not bending and is basically saying it will continue to defend Palestinians until the Israeli genocidal campaign is stopped. Hassan Nasrallah, the Secretary General of Hezbollah, said that Iran will definitely respond to the terrorist attack in Damascus. He also made the point that the Islamic Republic is deliberately exhausting Israel, forcing it to mobilize all of its resources and not knowing when, where, and how the Iranians will strike. Now, this is an interesting point because if we look, of course, the BBC is channeling Israeli bravado. Israel can handle any threat from Iran, says military chief. And the BBC, very much like the British government, did not condemn the Israeli aggression against Iran inside Damascus. And yet there are multiple reports stating that Israeli supermarkets flooded as terrified citizens empty shelves in fear of Iran attack. Now, from a perspective of sort of various discussions here, it's considered that what Iran will do potentially is to target the Israeli-occupied Golan territories. It will only target Israeli military bases. It's not going to try and hit embassies, as has much been reported in Western media, particularly because it's not going to jeopardize civilian life as Israel has done. And at the same time, it is considered, after discussions with its various allies in the region, there will be collaborative attacks by those resistance factions, potentially against U.S. bases in the region. This is only speculation. Nobody can actually say exactly what Iran is going to do. But in my opinion, it's going to be coming relatively soon, I would say in the next week.
Yes, thank you for that, Vanessa. Okay, if you like what the UK Column does, you'd like to support us, please head over to support.ukcolumn.org. All the options for helping us out are there. And since we are wholly funded by you, our viewers and listeners, that is a massive help to us if you can do that. But in any case, do share anything you find on the platform, especially ukcolumn.org, ukcolumnextracts.uk. .co.uk. But don't forget about the UK Column shop. There's plenty of stuff there. If you would like to get some merchandise, that would be fantastic. Quick advertisement, the No Smoke Without Fire, The Green King Part 4 went out yesterday. That's now on the UK Column website. Do have a look at that if you possibly can. And then tomorrow at 1 p.m., there'll be an interview with Professor David Barnheiser. I think that was yours, Charles.
No, that was Ben.
Ben, yes. Okay, it was Ben doing that one, so apologies for that. But anyway, do join us at 1 p.m. for that if you possibly can. Now, quick reminder that the Sounds Beautiful Festival is taking place June 27th to 30th in Dorset in Wimborne. There's a promotional code UK Column for that. And the organisers for this will be with us on Extra for a few minutes later on. So do join us for that to get a little bit more of the detail. A reminder of the Stand in the Light festival, which is taking place in May. That will be, there's also a promo code for this, UKC10, if you want 10%. That's May 24th to 27th. And we will be at both those events if you can go do come and say hello and so on. Now, yesterday I put this out on our newsletter, the Carshalton and Freedom Fair. And unfortunately, I said that that was beginning at 10 a.m., but that's because the stand in the park tends to meet at 10 a.m. at the Grove Park in Carshalton every Sunday. But in fact, the Freedom Fest Fair is taking place from 12 p.m. onwards, so don't arrive too early for that. Do go if you possibly can, if you're in the area. And then a final advertisement here for on Thursday this week, that's tomorrow. Society Controlled or Free, It's Up to Us event is taking place in London at the Emmanuel Centre beginning at 4:45. It's going to have Andrew Bridgen, Sandy Adams, Scott McCulloch and Jim Ferguson speaking with some guest speakings and a special screening of a new documentary from Mark Sharman. So if you can get along to that, that would be great as well. Okay, where does that take us? Let's talk about gender. And of course, the CAS report is out today. So this is the independent review of gender identity services for children and young people, headed up by Dr. Hilary CAS. This has come about because of the criticism of the way that the NHS has been dealing with this issue. And of course, that criticism has resulted in the closure of the Gender Identity Development Service, as we reported on the last news programme that I was on. I think this was on Friday. But we did make the point on Friday that two new hubs have already been established in order to continue this work. But anyway, coming back to the CAS report itself, let's look at the CAS review itself. Let's look at the report and its key findings. They say, or she says, there is no simple explanation for the increase in the numbers of predominantly young people and young adults that have a trans or gender diverse identity. Well, I'm going to question that a little bit later on, but we'll run through the other key findings first. There are conflicting views about the clinical approach, with expectations of care at times being far from usual clinical practice. An appraisal of international guidelines for care and treatment of children and young people with gender incongruence found that no single guideline could be applied in its entirety to the NHS in England. They also said that while a considerable amount of research has been published in this field, systematic evidence reviews demonstrated poor quality of the published studies. In other words, they're going ahead with treatment despite the lack of evidence. You may see parallels with COVID here, but anyway, it goes on to say the rationale for early puberty suppression remains unclear, with weak evidence regarding the impact on gender dysphoria, mental or psychological health. The effect on cognitive and psychosexual development remains unknown. Again, similar to COVID, let's just go ahead with the policy. Let's not worry about what the effect of jabs or the effect of lockdowns might be on people. The use of masculinizing or feminizing hormones in those under the age of 18 also presents many unknowns, despite their longstanding use in the adult transgender population. That's what they were saying. So the next thing is, clinicians are unable to determine with any certainty which children and young people will go on to have an enduring trans identity. And that, of course, comes back to the point that I was making also on Friday with the scientific paper showing that, in fact, the vast majority of youngsters lose this uncertainty about their gender as they grow up. But anyway, coming back to this issue of there is no simple explanation for the increase in the numbers of predominantly young people and young adults who have a trans or gender diverse identity, I would say there is a very simple explanation for this. And it derives from the policy which is being pushed from the World Health Organization and national government. So let's bring the World Health Organization on screen first. And of course, the World Health Organization is promoting the idea of gender-affirming care. And this is being promoted in schools through the relationships and sexual health education classes. And of course, these classes, although they're guided by a so-called national curriculum, what's actually taught in them is left up to the schools. And quite often the schools in the UK, at least, don't feel equipped to deal with these issues themselves. So they bring third parties into the schools to run this training. And it might be organisations like Mermaids, for example. Now, Mermaids is currently under investigation by the Charities Commission. That investigation's been running for well over a year now. But I just wanted to highlight, just as a throwaway comment here, the choice of colours on their website, because this looks to me like a common purpose based organisation. And I would suggest that a lot of this, the push for this ideology is coming from those kinds of circles. So the World Health Organisation, common purpose derived NGOs and charities, and also the government, and not just the domestic government either, because there's a press release from the Foreign, Commonwealth and Development Office, promoting and protecting the rights of LGBT plus people programme summary 2022 to 2023. This was published in March 23. And let's just look at their objectives. The UK is a champion for the human rights of LGBT plus people around the world. We support and advocate for the rights of all people, irrespective of their sexual orientation or gender identity, to live with dignity, free from prejudice, violence or discrimination, they say. Our objectives are to improve the lives of LGBT plus people through, first of all, improving institutional protection against discrimination, including through removing or amending discriminatory laws, policies and practices. Remember, this is Foreign Office policy. This is what they're pushing for in other countries. Never mind what's going on in the UK. Also reducing hate speech, violence or harassment based on discrimination. But the key one is the last one, which is all about improving access to services. And in other words, they want to replicate the types of services that we've seen being applied to children in the UK in other countries as well. And just to end this segment before I get a, see if either of our other contributors want to comment on this, I just want to show how, an example of how this is not just a UK thing. This is international. And so this is Dr. Phil, as he's known, Dr. Phil McGraw in the United States, talking about this.
States across the country have passed laws banning gender-affirming care on minors. Our next guest is a queer woman who is married to a trans man. When Jamie Reed worked as a caseworker at the Transgender Center at St. Louis Children's Hospital, she thought she was saving trans kids' lives. But she claims what she witnessed there was so morally and medically appalling that she had no choice but to expose what was really going on.
I was working in a pediatric gender center for 4.5 years, primarily responsible for patient intakes. The center followed this message that transition would solve everything, that it would solve a child's mental health problems. There were very few written protocols or guidelines. One of the providers even said we were flying the plane as we built it.
So since that is also recognized in this report, that seems to be a policy that's international. Vanessa, very briefly, have you got any thoughts on this?
No, I mean, it's just horrifying. I mean, that comment, flying the plane while you're still building it, I think that applies to so much of the policy that is coming through in the West and that is going to have a devastating effect in the future. Upon all generations, from elderly to future generations.
Yes, indeed. Charles, what are your thoughts?
Well, many, I think, and not good ones, but it shows, you know, propaganda and indoctrination works. You know, this stuff has been in the public eye, it's in schools. So to suggest at the outset that it doesn't seem to be clear why there's been an uptake or an increased interest in it is, I think, that's disingenuous. And I think also the, you know, targeting the policy allows those that are in the business of actually assisting people to either make transitions, whether chemically or surgically, it fails to scrutinise them. You know, questions particularly of the National Health Service and of all those other practitioners who are doing this stuff, they deserve far, far more attention than they're getting, I think.
Yes. Okay. Well, let's move on to the issue of human rights then.
Yeah, certainly. Now, not an enormous leap in a way from gender, but climate and the European Court of Human Rights, or for Human Rights, had a ruling yesterday, the Grand Chamber ruling on climate change cases. Now, you might be wondering what on earth this has to do with us or with anything else, but the Convention on Human Rights does not enshrine any right to a healthy environment as such. The European Court of Human Rights has been called upon to develop its case law in environmental matters on account of the fact that the exercise of certain convention rights may be undermined by the existence of harm to the environment and exposure to environmental risks. So I'll explain exactly what this is about. So effectively, a group of elderly Swiss ladies have complained that their government was not doing enough for them where it was concerning climate change or global warming, saying that they were concerned about the consequences of global warming on their living conditions and health. They consider that the Swiss authorities are not taking sufficient action, despite their duties under the convention, to mitigate the effects of climate change. And the court, this is the group, and those are the ladies involved, or at least they must be within that gaggle. The Grand Chamber held by a majority that there'd been a violation of Article 8, the right to respect for private and family life, of the convention. The court found in particular that Article 8 of the convention encompasses a right to effective protection by the state authorities from the serious adverse effects of climate change on lives, health, well-being, and quality of life. So the astonishing thing about this is it sees human rights being wielded, and in particular Article 8, the right to a private and family life, as actually demanding more state intervention and more state interference. But nonetheless, this is significant for the United Kingdom because, of course, whilst we are outside of the European Union, we are still very much obliged by the conventions under our membership of the Council of Europe, which means that we have certified and ratified the treaty. And therefore, how does that play out here? And what's the relevance? Or indeed, why does climate change in particular provoke sort of interest in other areas? And so we see that there has been reported from February by Client Earth, the High Court is running another case against the government about an inadequate climate action plan, again, human rights being cited. But what I want to draw your attention to is the relationship between the Human Rights Act 1998 and the Equality Act 2010. And we have here a slide from the Citizens Advice talking about protected characteristics and discrimination. Now, this is relevant because it comes on to the idea of philosophical beliefs. And it states that you cannot be discriminated against for your philosophical beliefs. So then go through what these are. You must genuinely hold the belief, it's moral, ethical, personal, or philosophical. And I've underlined, not an opinion based on facts. And then we have its important aspect of human life and behavior, it's serious and important. So I think you get the idea. But then it's worthy of respect in a democratic society and compatible with human dignity. They go on to say that some things courts have decided are philosophical beliefs include belief in climate change. So I refer back to it being opinion and not based on fact, which is very crucial in this type of legislation. They also say that the courts have decided philosophical beliefs cannot be believing the Holocaust didn't happen or being a member of a political party. This is further reinforced by the Equality and Human Rights Commission, where they effectively gave the same material. What justifies a philosophical belief? The Equality Act says a philosophical belief must be genuinely held and more than an opinion. And the example they give, lo and behold, an employee believes strongly in man-made climate change and feels that they have a duty to live their life in a way which limits their impact on the earth to help save it for future generations. This would be classed as a belief and protected under the Equality Act. And again, another example, again, talking about it being worthy of respect in democratic society. An employee believes that white people are a superior race to others and tells their colleagues so. This would not be classed as a belief protected under the Equality Act. So whilst it seems quite clear that there are sort of, in effect, double standards, the significant thing is, first of all, this climate change ruling for further state intervention under a human rights violation means that, in effect, the floodgates are open. But what should be clung to is the idea that a philosophical belief can also create case law where it concerns all of this material. So it'd be very interesting to see how this plays out. And the hope obviously will be that there'll be a significant number of legal challenges on the basis of opinions held equally strongly of the opposing view.
Yes. Thank you, Charles. Thank you for that. Now, let's come back to the Middle East now, Vanessa. And are we using AI to target people?
Absolutely. So if you remember, we reported on the Gospel AI system. Now we have a report released by the same media outlet that outed the Gospel system, a system called Lavender, the AI machine directing Israel's bombing spree in Gaza. So what does it actually entail? If we have a look at the report in a book in 2021 titled The Human Machine Team, How to Create Synergy Between Human and Artificial Intelligence That Will Revolutionize Our World, was released in English under the pen name Brigadier General YS. The author, a man who was confirmed to be the current commander of the elite Israeli intelligence unit A200, and people should remember that we have demonstrated how unit A200 not only develops the tech sector and startup in Israel, but is also embedded in our own tech sector and in various other sectors, including development of tech within the health sector, for example. So I just want to run a video by the journalist that actually wrote this article, Yuval Abraham, as he explains how the system actually works to massacre more Palestinians in Gaza. So if we can just roll that.
Even there is an AI-based system to create human targets, to mark them. So what it did, it at its peak, according to sources who have used it, it managed to mark 37,000 Palestinians in Gaza as suspected low-level Hamas or Jihad militants. Now, the way it works is, for people who don't know, like the machine scanned most of the population in Gaza, collecting surveilling information, and it gave each individual a rating between 1 to 100 based on how likely the machine thought that individual belonged to a military wing. It has a list of indicative features, which are really small signs that could be like somebody is in a WhatsApp group with a militant or somebody that replaces phones all the time, that raise or lower your rating. Now, sources said, and this is very, very important, that this machine, when they were using it, the IDF knew that in approximately 10% of the cases, it was making what was regarded as errors. So it was marking people who were complete civilians or had a very loose connection to Hamas. It's an automatic system that looks for these targets when they enter their family houses. So it scans thousands of people that were marked by Lavender, by the AI machine, and it alerts the intelligence officers the moment they enter their house. And the Israeli military, according to numerous sources, carried out a policy of bombing these people using unguided missiles when they were in the most civilian spaces, when they were inside family houses.
Basically, this was run in The Guardian, top Israeli spy chief. So Unit 8200 exposes his true identity in online security lapse, which was related to his book. But let's see how he describes the system. AI is used to create potential military targets, can be more efficient and avoid bottlenecks created by intelligence of human beings, in other words. There's a human bottleneck for both locating the new targets and decision-making to approve the targets. There is also the bottleneck of how to process a great amount of data. Then there's the bottleneck of connecting the intelligence to the fire. He adds, a team consisting of machines and investigators can blast the bottleneck wide open. But generally, in my opinion, Mike, and I'd be interested in yours, this suggests, as other people have said on social media, Gilad Atzmon saying that basically he considers that Israel is preparing for the Nuremberg trials. Louis Alde, who's a historian and an expert on Palestinian history, he says the AI piece is suspicious, not only because of that publication's track record, and as it couldn't have been published without Israeli military sign-off, but because claiming targeting is happening with no human input seems like an obvious attempt to avoid accountability. Now, I would agree with that. I think there's two things here. One is the future of AI. Are we going to start to see drones being controlled by AI, which has to have the algorithm input by a human being, right? But what it will eventually do is to provide this lack of accountability for the human participation in whatever crimes or atrocities are being committed.
Yeah, I mean, I think we can't allow that because that is how it seems to me. I think we can't allow that danger of removing accountability to hold. And so if they're going to use AI, which I think we should all be opposing and opposing extremely strongly, then whoever makes the decision to deploy that AI system needs to be the person that's ultimately accountable for it. There should be no attempt to get away from this. Charles, let's come back to you and the question of protest in the UK.
Thanks, Mike. Yes, an announcement by the Home Office that they have introduced new measures for police and courts to deal with what they're calling serious disruption and clamping down on that. A tweet here critically showing that new powers will prevent serious disruptions at protests before it occurs. So is it pre-crime that we're dealing with? This comes from the Public Order Act of last year, 2023, within which there was provision for what are called serious disruption prevention orders, which are to be doled out by courts, either on conviction or in other circumstances. But so we'll just run through some of the clauses here. And they're both to prevent a person from committing a protest-related offence or to prevent activities related to protests that are, that will result in or are likely to result in serious disruption. And note that the threshold is very low, to two or more individuals. Of course, it goes on to suggest that it's to prevent from causing or contributing the commission by any other person or carrying out by any other person, again, using the phrase likely to result in. So broad tentacles and a low threshold, but particularly the order itself may require the person to do anything described in the order or to prohibit them from doing anything described in the order. We'll just have a sample of what the not doing things are, the prohibitions. So being or entering a particular place or area, being or entering particular place between particular times, and the same thing on any day, being with particular persons, participating in particular activities, having particular articles. So note that it's completely non-specific, and in effect, it will enable orders to be made and actions to be taken that, in effect, stop people from doing absolutely anything. And the most important thing to point out is that in order to put in an order that relates to a criminal activity, which might perhaps be serious disruption, the threshold has been changed to civil. So all this is being done on the balance of probabilities, which means that people who have no previous history of serious disruption may still fall foul of this. And the other thing to point out, of course, is that once this is in place, the surveillance and monitoring requirement is likely to be enormous, and therefore it's a huge intrusion into the private lives of people who may actually not have caused any of the activities the Home Office is saying they want to stop. Of course, where's it come from? Well, we see that there's been very high-profile activism, which has created the idea that all protest in some way is troublesome and disruptive. So we'll just have a look at a couple of those now. And the most notable ones, of course, being Just Stop Oil. We always follow the money. So where is their money coming from? They say that it's coming from the Climate Emergency Fund. So we have a look here talking about brave activists and people waking up to the climate emergency. But of course, behind this are people like Eileen Getty and Rory Kennedy leading a new climate fund. So effectively people with very, very deep pockets, the consequences of which are that any form of dissent and protest can effectively be lumped in with this and crushed. More from the Getty Association Protecting Our World. Extinction Rebellion being another very high profile example. And again, they on their funding thing, they talk about major donors. Well, who exactly would they be referring to? One of the more well-known ones is Christopher Hone, who's the chief executive and founder of TCI Fund Management, a hedge fund. And of course, it's worth pointing out that previously the Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, worked with and for Hone in this environment. So I think the point to be made here is that this is it looks very much like a completely contrived piece of legislation through very high-profile activities that have given cause to not only the offences listed in the Public Order Act 2023, but also the intimation that protest is, in effect, on the way out and should be clamped down upon before it's even happened.
Yes, and Charles, I didn't put the graphic in here, but we need to always keep in mind that piece of legislation or a particular agenda shouldn't be seen as a single item on its own. It has to be seen in the context of the other legislation that we've seen being put in place over the last 3, 4, 5 years, which is all designed. I mean, we've now got multiple legislation designed to restrict the ability to protest. We've got multiple legislation designed to restrict the ability to express ourselves online. We're seeing pretty dictatorial policies being implemented in the form of legislation.
Yeah, we are. Absolutely, we are. And I think the other thing that's worth noting, of course, is this is, in effect, the inversion and the moving away from intent towards a supposed victim being able to describe what has happened to them. And that in effect is what is taken by the authorities as having happened. And of course, that's a move away from what one might call traditional legislation, where it's very important to prove the intent that somebody had when undertaking any of these activities. But yeah, and as you say, you know, the Criminal Justice Bill is absolutely one to watch out for, with all the things that it's going to be bringing in, you know, on related subjects.
Yes, indeed. Okay, thank you, Charles. Back to you, Vanessa. And, well, an interesting article in the Daily Mail.
Yes, interesting article. I think we're seeing, you know, the inevitable witch hunt for MP George Galloway starting. This is by Abul Taher, described as their security correspondent. Outrages newly elected MP George Galloway interviews extremists, urging people to join up with terrorists fighting Israel on Iranian propaganda channel. So the left-wing firebrand is hosting a new press TV show, and he interviewed Marwa Osman, who we know, of course, Mike, you've interviewed her, very dear friend of mine, Dr. Marwa Osman, PhD. And the claim was that she was effectively recruiting people to Hezbollah, which is a proscribed terrorist organization, despite being a political party in Lebanon, proscribed in the UK since 2019. So in the article itself, he does actually ask Galloway for comment. A spokesman for the Community Security Trust, which is known to be a Zionist lobbying operation inside the UK, which monitors anti-Semitic attacks. Dr. Osman is encouraging British citizens to go and fight in support of Hezbollah. That alone should be a matter for the police. Galloway told the Mail on Sunday Dr. Osman was addressing Arabs in the Arab world, not British people. It's also interesting that only Galloway was asked for a comment. Dr. Marwa Osman was not contacted until now for any comment. Alicia Kearns, who we mentioned last week, who basically highlighted the fact that the British government was not revealing the fact that legal advisors had informed them that Israel is breaking international law. She said it's unacceptable for an MP to host a show on the Iranian regime's propaganda arm. Press TV had its license revoked by Ofcom. For an MP to sit by in silence as someone recruits for a terrorist group is truly unforgivable. She must have forgotten that it can be argued that MI6 recruited for Al-Qaeda inside Syria. But she didn't mention that. David Miller retorted to Alicia Kearns, saying that she's back on the day job pushing anti-Iran propaganda for MI6. More fool those who fell for her crocodile tears for Palestinians. What he actually claims is that Kearns merely represents the sector of the security state, which sees unfettered revisionist Zionism as a threat to the status quo of gradual rather than sudden genocide of the Palestinians. So here she is course correcting and reminding her superiors she's still a bloodthirsty imperialist who loathes Muslim sovereignty in the Muslim world. So I just wanted to play a section of Marwa's response to the Daily Mail. You can find it on her Telegram channel if you want to see the whole of her response. So here's the section.
This video, I will explain each part of this article and talk more about what the Daily Mail was actually promoting not very long ago. As you see here, I did say that in Lebanon, there's the resistance, the Mukawama, and there's the Saraya Mukawama, the resistance brigades, where if you really believe in the resistance as a tool to liberate Palestine and help the natives in Palestine against this gruesome genocidal war against them, you can take part in that. And I don't think that is telling anyone to join any terrorist group, because for one, I'm a native in the region of what you call the Middle East, what I call West Asia, and we are defending ourselves against colonial settlers and colonial entities who are actively being armed and funded by the UK and the United States of America. I want UK citizens to join our resistance right here against the Zionist entity, who are happy with our resistance and the effort it has been exerting to support our brothers and sisters in Palestine. We are also happy with all the resistance that is coming from Syria, from Iraq, from Yemen, and from Palestine itself. We do support the resistance against any resistance in the world against aggressors, occupiers, and colonialists. colonial settlers. In the end, I'd like to thank the Daily Mail for using this very cute photo of me. I absolutely love it. You can spew all the pro-genocide propaganda that you want. You can attempt to smear our names because we fight for the people who are currently under genocide. This will not stop us. We will remain steadfast.
And Vanessa, you were talking about MI6 recruiting for Al-Qaeda in Syria, but of course the other name that we should mention here is Liz Truss.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, okay. Well, look, thank you for that. Now, we'll just end very quickly. I just want to highlight an article in the Daily Star. World dangerously close to next pandemic with deadly virus 100 times worse than COVID. More propaganda pushing the H1N1 virus. Well, what can we say about that? They decided to conflate the thing with a piece of video from Matt Hancock being what they describe as grilled on the pandemic by campmates on I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here. I mean, it's just incredible that they have had the gall to publish this article. But I just want to end with this thought, and I'm going to get some thoughts from Vanessa about this because I think she'll agree with this, which is doing the rounds on social media at the moment. I think I agree with this. We're not from the left or the right. We're from the bottom, and we're coming for those on top. I think that sums things up fairly well, and we'll leave you with that thought for now. So I'm going to say thank you very much to everybody who's watched today. Thank you to Vanessa and Charles for your input. We'll be back in a couple of minutes with a couple of special guests for UK Column News Extra. We'll see you then if you're a UK Column member. Otherwise, don't forget the interview at 1 p.m. tomorrow, and then we'll be back for the news at 1 p.m. on Friday. See you then. Bye-bye.